Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Joe Zimmel and Valerie Friedman.
I get the neck of the chicken. I get the rumble seat ride. I get the leaky umbrella. Everyone shoves me aside. When I wake up each day with the dawn, sure as fate, I'm too late, and all the hot water's gone. I get the neck of the chicken. I get the hand-me-down tie. I get the cock in the kitchen. I get the small piece of pie. That's why I can't get over this dream come true. Now, if I get the neck of the chicken, how did I ever get to?
You know why we're opening the show with that song? By the way, today's Ask or Tell Me Anything. And you can now call in. We believe you can call in at 888-720-9677, 888-720-WNPR. Had a little problem with the phones a little while ago, like 20 minutes ago. It seemed like maybe there wouldn't be a show. I think this may be caused by the eclipse. Can the eclipse cause things even though it's not here yet? Anyway, so yesterday, in fact, I was making a chicken. I was putting a chicken in the crock pot. And you know, they sell you a chicken, they always sell you the neck too. Like, what are you going to do with it? I mean, you can make stock or something. So, or you could take stock. So anyway, my significant other, is watching me put the chicken in the pot. And I decided I'm going to just sort of wriggle the neck into the crock pot there too. And she's looking at me and do this. And I said, well, I got to do something with it. And then I started to sing, I get the neck of the chicken, you know. And like I sang the first verse of the song. And which I think is kind of a lovely song. Anyway, and I said to her that, you know, I'm pretty sure Frank Lesser wrote that song. And she looked at me, she said, that's a real song? So yes, that's a real song. So you just heard Bob Dureau singing that song by Frank Lesser. Jimmy McHugh wrote it with him, I think. Frank Lesser, of course, wrote like all the Guys and Dolls. That's all you need to know. But for the rest of the show, that's Bob Dureau, the great songwriter, who was actually on this show years ago. He's now no longer with us, but, or maybe he is. But for the rest of the show, we're only going to use songs that were written by Bob Dureau. He's just singing that song. All right. I thought you would want to know that. It's Ask or Tell Me Anything. It's the number to call. You can bring up any topic you want. It's 888-720-9677. 888-720-WNPR. I'm laughing because one of the solutions we were thinking about when the phone system didn't work would be that I would see the calls on a screen that is located, I'm going to say 12 feet away from me. And and the reality is that I'm supposed to schedule a cataract surgery. See, this is what happens. You get to be 69 years old, and just all this stuff, you know, it's just like various parts of your body that you kind of took for granted, like all of them, stop working. So I was just looking in, over at this thing that's 12 feet away and wondering whether I could see little tiny type on it. And, you know, that's going to be basically those kinds of questions will be the next 10 years. If I'm lucky, those will be the next 10 years. I've got some things that I specifically want to talk about, but I would much rather, all right, so that's an interesting question. I don't know the answer to it, but I would rather hear from you and rather put you on the air, and we will do that at 888-720-9677, 888-720-WNPR. All right, so here we go. We're going to begin. We're going to see if this phone system works. Ray from Hamden, you are the dog we're shooting up into space like the Russians did. Poor Leica. Leica didn't make it back. People forget that. Ray, you're going to do much better. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Colin. I wanted to ask you, why it is that you think both NPR, the U.S. government, and in general the American media, when reporting about civilian deaths in Gaza, failed to take note of the fact that here the death toll has, in fact, is in fact vastly lower now than it used to be. Start of the war, about 350 or so a day, which is horrific. It is still a horrific number, but it's probably rather less than half that at this point. And so, in fact, Israel has significantly decreased civilian death toll, and yet the press seems not to take any notice of that at all, but seems to report things as though the death toll were just as high as it used to be. 32,000 dead is absolutely horrific, but the rate at which civilians are dying as a result of bombing, which has been provoked by the war crimes committed by Hamas, is vastly, vastly lower. And yet, that never seems to get reported.
Well, I mean, first of all, I'm just taking your word for all of this. A, that it's not being reported. I mean, I haven't been particularly attentive to that. And B, that the death toll is lower, although I don't know how I would know that if it's not being reported. But I'll say this. I can at least offer this much. First of all, if we were to do that, if the press were in general to do that, there would be, and I'm trying to figure out like what that would look like, Israel not killing quite as many civilians every day. The chorus from the other side would be every bit as loud, if not louder, than what you're doing right now. In other words, I think the argument from the other side would be the original death toll, the civilian death toll, it was, to use your word, horrific. And that to make it a news story that it's half as horrific as it used to be and make that seem like some kind of desirable process when, you know, I think the majority of people beholding this want a ceasefire, not let's only kill 175 civilians every day. So, I mean, I'm granting, because I don't know one way or another, I'm stipulating that you're right about what you say. I don't know what that story looks like if we reported it differently.
Well, it looks like graphs that we had when COVID was raging, for one thing. It's very easy, actually, to present that kind of information graphically. It should be clear about the lower death toll simply from the fact that, you know, the death toll now, about 32,000. About a month ago, it was 30,000. But, you know, you can see vastly lower numbers. And the very fact that you're saying that you are not aware of that, when you are somebody who is, you know, very attentive to the news, I think is itself an indication of the failure of American news to be reporting accurately, especially when, in terms of the politics, it's as though Israel is engaging in, you know, horrific, you know, slaying of civilians, not putting the blame on Hamas the way that it should be, but as though there, in fact, had not been a change in Israeli policy. Because for months, the U.S. government has been urging Israel to change its policy. And very clearly, the change in death toll indicates that, in fact, it has been responsive. Not as responsive as we might want. And certainly, you know, I, too, would hope for, you know, release of all the people whose detention remains a war crime on the part of Hamas. And accordingly, and a ceasefire as well. And eventually peace talks with somebody or other. But you can't really talk about the politics if you're not actually giving the information.
Yeah, I'll say this. First of all, my biggest fear right now is that a lot of other people are going to call up about this, and it's not a show I want to do or even feel particularly prepared to do. You know, I need to look at this some more to have an intelligent conversation with you about it, okay. As both of us are acknowledging. I don't have enough facts in front of me. I will say this, just listening to you talk, I'm laughing grimly. You seem to, anyway, have decided that there's a certain number of civilian casualties that is horrific, and that, like, the other number isn't. I'm not exactly sure how we decide that. You know, there are probably people who say if 10 kids die every day as civilian casualties, that's horrific. So, I mean, yeah, I would agree that if, in fact, it's true that they're stepping it down. They're trying to exercise a little bit more proportionality and discretion. Although it's a little late for proportionality at this point. You know, that's worth reporting, and maybe there should be a graph here or there. But I think the big story is there going to be a ceasefire or there isn't, or isn't there? I think that's of greater importance to most people. But, you know, I mean, yeah, I would be willing to concede your point that if, in fact, this is underreported, it should be reported. I mean, you know, germane facts should be reported. But I don't think it's maybe quite the achievement that you think it is. Anyway, Hopefully we'll be talking about other stuff, because I really don't want to spend 49 minutes on this, just because, you know, a certain level of emotion quickly gets reached about it among people. All right, we're going to go to one of our stalwarts here. No, we're not yet. He's not quite ready. We're going to go to someone who could very easily be a stalwart, and that would be David from Mansfield. Hi, David. You have the David. Yeah, you have the floor. You're on. You are on the air.
Well, thank you. I'll bring it back to a local issue, so we don't have to talk about that. It's not that the other issue wasn't important, mm-hmm. but there's a bill in the state legislature now that's going by the moniker of Work, Live, Ride. And it's being pushed by an organization called Desegregate Connecticut, which is actually a misnomer for where that organization actually came from. Yeah, there are some areas in the state that need more affordable housing, Mansfield among those. But the bill, as it's construed, would assign sweeping powers to an individual, an appointed individual, who would be allowed to override local planning and zoning commissions, would be able to put very high density, like for a rural area, 10 or 11 units per acre is a very high density. But it's disingenuous for this organization to call it so. I mean, nobody can be against desegregation. But this bill is just not a good thing for the parts of Connecticut that are not already developed. The funding that would go into it is primarily a 203 area code benefit. But any of that funding that we can't use in a semi-rural place like this is not going to be available for other things that we do need.
Yeah, I mean, so I don't. Well, this is the second call of the day that I probably don't know enough about to be commenting on. One thing that I would, I'm kind of looking right now on my screen a little bit about the bill, but it's certainly something that we've talked about on Ask or Tell Me Anything before. And I first of all, a bill going through the General Assembly is a complicated process. If the bill is as you described it, I would be surprised if it passes and gets signed. On the other hand, what's happened and what I think maybe has brought us to this point is years and years and years of trying to create incentives, trying to create mandates, trying to order towns that don't want to have affordable housing to have it. I think people are getting frustrated, are looking for an answer. This didn't come up yesterday, right? We've been having this affordable conversation, the affordable housing conversation, in some ways for decades. I've talked about that before on Ask or Tell Me Anything. It goes all the way back. I mean, I covered it in the 1970s. That's how old it is. And I think there is increasingly the feeling that local autonomy is a big part of the problem. That if you say to Darien or New Canaan, you know, we'd really, really, really like it a lot if you would build some affordable housing, they won't. And if you say to them, because they're wealthy towns, we're going to withhold, you know, X amount of other kinds of monies or whatever, they'll say, okay, fine. And I think people are looking for a stick. I think carrots have not really worked all that well. And you really do have this. I mean, the reason it's called what it's called is that people can't live where they work, and they can't easily even get to where they work. And that's really ridiculous, you know. In a state the size of Connecticut, it's just ridiculous that we have that kind of a problem. But I think we definitely do. And a lot of these towns, it's just insane. The people who work at town hall can't live in the town. I mean, they literally can't afford to live there. So I don't know. I don't know enough about this bill to critique it one way or another. But I will say I do understand the frustration. If everybody had acted in good faith in the years that preceded this one, we probably wouldn't be at a juncture like that.
Well, let me throw one other thing into this. First of all, the affordable housing that we are getting built now, anything affordable housing in the Mansfield area becomes student dorms eventually. And that's just right now we've got several developments going up in the north end of Mansfield that are just, there are thousands of apartments going in. But these are not intended for the rest of the world. if you go to a place like Mansfield, how do work, live, ride? Okay, yeah, if you set up a bus in a bus line from Mansfield, how are you going to get these people to where the jobs are going to be? We don't have a big industrial base out here. So it's really, you know, there's a gap. And yes, absolutely, we need more affordable housing, and the town council and the planning and zoning folks are working hard on that. But this is not the solution.
All right. Well, to be continued, David. Thanks for your call. We have another Dave calling in. He is Lake Como Dave, calling in from Ohio, from beautiful Ohio. Lake Como Dave, welcome to the show.
And I might add, calling in from the Path of Totality, the town that we live in, up along the lakeshore in northeast Ohio, smack in the middle of the, you know, total eclipse.
So this is probably the last time we'll ever speak to you again, because I'm pretty sure the eclipse is going to bring destruction and worse.
Yeah, usually it's tornadoes that would go through here, you know. But, this should be interesting. But
I should say...
Go ahead.
Oh, I should say that our Thursday episode this week, produced by McCusker the Wonder, the Whiz Kid, and her, McCusker the Wonder Kid and her bad cat Penelope, is going to be about, it's going to be kind of about eclipse fear quite a bit, that there inevitably have been throughout history panics around eclipses. And of course, in today's information and paranoia saturated attention economy, it's even worse. Like, I sent something to her over the weekend. Yeah. It's like they're starting the CERN accelerator up on the day of the eclipse or something. And for some reason or other, people are connecting like a Higgs boson is going to get out and start penetrating our brains. Or I don't even know what the end then is of this particular story, but it is kind of hilarious. Anyway, that's not what you called about.
Oh, that's okay. I do have a question in here somewhere, but it takes a quick setup. So here I go. When you watch MSNBC these days, you know, there's a lot of never Trumpers, you know, sane Republicans that have found a home there, either as commentators or now even hosts. You know, Nicole Wallace, Michael Steele, Susan Del Perso, Rick Wilson, who was an implacable enemy to Democrats in the past, even Bill Kristol, you know, he as a commentator on that network would have been unimaginable a few years ago. But they've made obviously common cause with Democrats to prevent a second Trump presidency. But, you know, in so doing, they've also saved their careers because they'd have no jobs as Republican strategists. So my question is, imagine, let's put the rose colored glasses on and imagine that, you know, Biden wins. The Democrats have both houses of Congress, you know, 4 years of sane governance, whatever. We get to the end of that period. We're also kind of, in my opinion, at the end of the period of octogenarian candidates. And, you know, it's kind of a wide open field for who would be the candidates from either party. What happens to these people? This is finally the question. The folks that we've come to like that are, you know, on MSNBC, do those warm feelings fade? Do they disappear? Do they go back to, you know, pushing Republican causes and you know, are they no longer our friends? That's my question.
I think it's a great question, and it's one that I am very prepared to talk about. In fact, I've been thinking about it all weekend. My class is tomorrow. We're going to really be discussing the way in which journalism either does or does not have to point the way towards, you know, or point out the perils that are implicit in Donald Trump. And whether they're doing a good job and whether it matters and all that kind of stuff. I would say a few of the following things. I think, first of all, the thing that you're asking is really interesting, and it's something that people don't talk about very much. Let's assume a Biden victory, and let's assume a Biden victory that's a relatively comfortable one. You know, that let's say he gets more than 325 electoral votes. I'm just picking a number. So let's imagine a considerably bigger margin than that, so that we're not consumed once again by allegations trying to dispute the actual outcome of the election. I think what happens then is kind of up to the Republican Party initially and not up to everybody else. I mean, it does appear to have become the party of Trump. It does appear to have become the kind of party which, if Trump became less and less relevant, having lost a second election, would be the case. If he becomes less relevant, I think there's a huge question, which is, do we get something back that looks a little bit more like the old Republican Party? That would be kind of a blend of people who are kind of center right and then people who are hard right, old fashioned red meat conservatives. You know, but I mean, people you could have a conversation with. I don't think that that could happen, that kind of regeneration could happen over a short window. I mean, for one thing, you've got, you know, all these crazy people in Congress. I mean, there's not that many of them, but let's imagine, I mean, everything that's happened in the most recent sets of cycles has essentially discredited the Trumpian vision, right? They're losing ground. They're losing elections that they might have thought that they were going to win in some of the non-presidential cycles. So there's an argument to be made, like, wow, let's maybe just get back to what we used to do. And I don't know whether that's possible or not. I would also say, just to button onto the last thing that you said, I consider normal Republicans to be my friends. And I have friends who are normal Republicans. They're non-Trumpy Republicans. They don't like what has happened. They've searched their own souls. Should they go off? Should they start another party? Should they? What should they do? I think that if Trump loses this time and loses decisively, they can have a different kind of conversation. They don't have to think about necessarily starting another party. They could argue, give us our party back. And that conversation will mostly happen state by state, sometimes even at the local level, right? That's where your voices get heard. I mean, I think in Connecticut, for example, that the normal Republicans who outnumber the Trumpy Republicans might well organize themselves and rise up. I say they outnumber the Trumpy Republicans, and this is a point that I've made before. What happened in the last cycle when Themis Claridis was seeking the nomination to run for U.S. Senate, and she's a non-Trumpy Republican, and instead Lior Levy won the primary because they had a primary in August and it was like 47,000 votes or something. You know, I mean, Dick Blumenthal, you know, gets a million votes. So I think there would be a great argument that the Republicans could make to me, say, okay, this is over. We've got to stop doing this. People don't like it and we're losing elections. And so let's get back to being ourselves. And then it might be incumbent on us, Lake Como Dave, to say to ourselves, okay, if they do that, I think we ought to acknowledge it. I think we ought to, you know, meet them halfway on some of this stuff. We ought to go back to having a less polarized society and maybe a government that can function on something other than partisan terms. I mean, maybe I'm just a loopy dreamer when I say that, but to me, you know, that's the good outcome. I at first thought you were going to ask what happens to the Never Trumpers if Trump wins. And that's a much more, glaringly, that's a much more Stalin-like question. But I don't know. Any final thoughts here from Ohio?
Yeah, I would say, you know how we judge people from the Red Scare time of the 50s by what they said and did during, you know, did they rat people out or report them as communists to the HUAC, you know, the committee, so forth. I'm hopeful that if we survive this fall, that a similar stigma will attach itself to Republicans who publicly supported all this madness, and that they will simply be, except in the most depraved parts of the country, they will be excluded from having a place at the table in future public life.
Yeah, I mean, it might be sort of like, you know, Chile after Pinochet. I mean, whenever something like that goes away, it turns out nobody had anything to do with it. There's a great movie, a great moment in that original movie, Gloria, which was set in Chile, where there's a dinner party. And it's just, there's a moment where it's just clear that everybody's thinking, because they don't know each other very well, what were you doing then? What exactly were you doing? I don't think it's that extreme. I think if he wins, it will get that extreme. But yes, my guess is that if he loses and the whole thing's discredited, it'll turn out there are like 7 or 8 people who really like Trump at all. Anyway, thanks so much for your call. We've got other people calling in. We've got John. We've got Richard. We've got Anthony. We've got Mike. These are all very interesting calls. So hang on. We'll take a break. We'll come back.
No cares for me. I'm happy as I can be. I've learned to love and to live. Devil may care. No cares or woes. Whatever comes later goes. That's how I'll take and I'll give. Devil may care. When the night is through, I suffer no regrets.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare.
Loneliness can be a significant health risk to people of all ages. Dr. Laura Saunders, a psychologist from Hartford HealthCare's Institute of Living, talks about social isolation and why we need to connect in person.
Loneliness actually is a pretty significant health risk for people that struggle with social isolation. It affects their blood pressure, it affects their immune system, it affects your willingness to get up and get out, and can cause some not just emotional issues, but health problems as well.
You're not alone. Dr. Saunders explains how important it is for us to look to others and get out of our comfort zone.
I like to talk about social isolation as not just that individual's problem, but it's a community problem or it's a family problem. We need to connect with others. We can take space at times as well, but we need to step out of our comfort zone and do things to connect with other people. It's life-saving.
For more information, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
Just about everything I need to make this life I lead an enjoyable thing. I've got robins and roses and bluebirds and posies, all kinds of flowers that bloom, all kinds of birds that sing. I've got just about everything I want to make this earth I walk a miraculous place. I've got fresh air and sunshine and mountains and Maine wine and what's really a boon. I like the human race when I say just about everything.
You know, I picked all this music out yesterday, and it kind of doesn't fit the conversation so far. But that's more music by Bob Dureau, and I'm staying with it. I was in a good mood yesterday, and I'm still sort of in a good mood today. All right, so we're taking your calls here. Ask or tell me anything. 888-720-9677, 888-720-WNPR. You know, Le Como Dieu is actually in the classical music business, and one of the things that I was putatively ready to do today was to talk to somebody about Shostakovich, but he didn't bring that up. I don't know. You know, you can't get ready for this show. There's no point in preparing for it. All right, so here is a phone call from Richard in Mystic. Hi, Richard.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
This is the second time I've called into you. The first time was February 28th, 2022, after I had just received a letter from a friend of mine who was in Kyiv, and it was so strong a letter, I read it online. It was about her having a hot morning, a hot hellish afternoon, about the bombs going off in her neighborhood and her neighbors being killed by flying glass. Now, we've moved forward. She initially, the next letter that she wrote me, she was talking about, my weapon is my Ukrainian soul. My ancestors were strong. I'm strong. My grandchildren were strong. And she continued on about how her city was on fire and that she would not give up. And then she talked about how the Ukrainian military, these guys are so fearless, self-confident. They love our land so much. I see it in their faces. I hear it. And what they say, they will not give up Ukraine. We Ukrainians are lucky to be alive. Now, the reason I bring this up is because 2 years later, we have certainly done a lot to support them. But since December, the party of Trump has denied the things that they need to defend themselves. And now this is not just an international issue. This is also a local issue, because if we don't give Ukraine what they need, then we will be actually fighting for democracy ourselves. They're doing the fighting for us. So I think it's very, very important that we do everything we can, not only to get the bill that's before Congress now passed as quickly as possible, but to also make sure we have the right kind of weapons for them so they can do it. Now, I'm going to do one more point, and then I'm just going to sort of make a couple of comments. The most recent letter that I got, pretty close to it, was after the fall of the small village of Adivka, and I cannot pronounce it correctly. That was the one where the Ukrainians were holding it because it was a very important psychological situation where if the Russians took it, it was going to demoralize the Ukrainians. Russia lost 47,000 men trying to take this, according to Newsweek, where Washington Post said that Ukraine only lost about 5,000 men, and 1,000, somewhere between 800 and 1,000 of them were lost the last day as they were trying to evacuate. And the reason they evacuated is they had run out of ammunition. Excuse me for stuttering, but I get so angry at Congress for the blood that's on their hands. So her letter after that was, there are no improvements. There will be no improvements. And to be honest, the idea of Russia will take over Ukraine does not seem bad to me anymore. Both in Russia and in Ukraine, politicians are thieves and deceivers. The only difference is that when Russia comes, at least missiles will not fly at Ukrainians, and we will be sleep peacefully in our homes without the fear of being under the rubble in the morning. It's pointless to fight against the power of Russia possesses, and probably the Pope was right when he said it's time for Ukrainian to raise the white flag. Now, to go from her absolute Ukrainian spirit. She was calling herself a Terminator. She was volunteering to help take care of the animals in the zoo the first few days. And I could go on for quite a bit. We're letting them down. We need to do that. And democracy and the world order is in the balance. So it comes right back to our local needs. If we don't support them, if we don't remember that this is going on with all the other stuff going on in the world, whether it's the Gaza situation or Trumpism, totalitarianism will win if Ukraine loses. China will see that we did not support them the way we should. So those Trumpers who say we should be paying attention to China, they're going to move into Taiwan as soon as we allow Ukraine to lose. So I'm imploring everyone, please, 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 don't let the news cycle make you lose sight of how vitally important for our interests, never mind Ukrainians, but for our interests, that we do support them every possible way we can. So we could go on a lot discussing it, I'm sure. But I did want to make that point very strongly.
I think you did make it very strongly. And we do have some other calls here. And the one thing that I would say about this is, I'm sort of surprised to hear about that letter writer, but I'm also not surprised. When you really think about it. And if you're there, you may desire an end to war a lot more than you desire victory. I think also, you look at the way in which they're dependent on aid. They get it from NATO, but really we're going to be always the big player in this conversation. And so on the one hand, you've got Putin, who, first of all, is very, very, very determined to get what he wants here. But he's added to that is the look. Even what Richard just described there, the idea that there'd be a 47,000 to 5,000 differential in one fight. The Russian armies look really bad in all this. They've looked ineffectual. They've looked like a second or third rate military power. And you know that grates on Putin. He's got a point to prove, and he's not going to walk away from this until he thinks he's proved it. So you have that kind of determination on one side. And then look on our side. Like Mike Johnson is trying to, get his caucus to maybe do something about this. It is also clear that whatever kind of support Ukraine is getting, it's kind of leasing for another 6 months or so until we see how the election comes out. If Trump wins, it's over. In some ways, it might make more sense to try to make a deal. If you thought Trump was going to win in November and you're Zelensky or anybody else over there, you might be thinking, maybe the time to make the deal is now, because when Trump gets in, there's no, it'll be much harder to make a deal. We have fewer cards to play. So, I kind of get how maybe she might have shifted in all that. The other thing I will say is that's a very articulate and imagistic letter writer. Those are, it seems to be kind of a theme here. Ukrainians are really good at expressing themselves. And sometimes that helps as well. All right. So let's go from here to Anthony in New Haven. Hi, you have the floor, Anthony.
Thank you, Colin. Six-time caller, so I got your previous caller beat.
Is there some kind of thing we have to give you? There's like a coin or something? We should work out some kind of system like that. Like your sixth time, you should get something,
You really should.
A rubber duck. We got loads of them.
So you did a show a few weeks ago that I thought was really good on the crisis. Sort of different types of crises. You had a crisis management expert on. And one of the things you talked about was how the definition or concept of a crisis has really sort of changed or expanded over the years, you know, using the Cuban Missile Crisis as an example of a, you know, the kind of crisis that we recognize as a crisis. And now things that don't necessarily have a start or an end date, the opioid crisis, the border crisis, have come into use. And I thought that was really interesting. And I wanted to connect it to another show you did recently, which may have been a re-airing, but it was on, I believe it was on government actions, or, and part of it was on conspiracies. And you talked about the climate change conspiracy and the idea of how ridiculous it is. I forget what number of people you said would have to be involved. And I think, you know, that in a similar way, sort of, I think the definition of a conspiracy has sort of expanded beyond a, you know, meeting of the minds of a group of people. And I think has kind of morphed into, you know, some sort of structural definition where there's a structural thing in place that leads to a certain outcome. You know, and I'll use the example of Bernie Sanders using the term rigged. You know, when he said the economy was rigged, he didn't mean that literally there were people manipulating the stock market or GDP or things of that nature. I think he meant there the way the structure, the system in place as constructed leads to a sort of predictable outcome. And I think so in that way, I think the climate change conspiracy, I think what someone who supports that conspiracy, and just to be clear, I don't. I think what they would say was not that there's a group of people, you know, manipulating the data and falsifying data. Rather, I think they would say that the incentives in place, the incentives of climate change scientists, the incentives of politicians, of people of a certain political persuasion leads them to interpret data in a way that leads to an outcome that they would like to have. So I'm just curious on your thoughts of, you know, whether you think the definition of conspiracy has changed or morphed.
Oh, it absolutely has. I mean, in the ways that you're describing. I mean, I would say that a conspiracy is now a label that's just kind of pasted over anything a certain group of people don't like. I mean, suggesting, for example, that everything that's been said about climate change is a lie, and that a lie that has some kind of end purpose to it. I mean, just imagine that. First of all, you're imagining that there's somebody more powerful than the petroleum companies. You know, that I mean, the most powerful people would be theoretically be powerless in the face of this incredible conspiracy. It's not even it wouldn't even be a conspiracy, right? I think I just watched last night The Truth versus Alex Jones, this searing documentary on HBO, on Max, that's in mostly about the two trials in Texas and Connecticut, but also just sort of about the Alex Jones information empire, such as it is, and how he operates and how he gets people to operate with him. And I mean, when you think about that, I mean, the notion that in order to be able to enact stronger gun laws, somebody, some coalition of the government and apparently, you know, repertory theater groups around the country or something, that fake school shootings are being staged and covered up by hundreds. And I mean, whenever you talk to somebody who believes that, you know, it's just, I mean, I just wind up saying, I know these people. I mean, I knew some of these people before it happened. I certainly have met the people since then. I mean, it's just such an insane thing. And I think motivation is more powerful than plausibility in these situations. I mean, it doesn't really make any sense to think that Sandy Hook or anything like that was a conspiracy or a cover-up or a false flag or whatever you want to call it. But it doesn't matter that it doesn't make any sense, because these are no longer rational arguments. I would say the same thing about people claiming that climate change is some kind of hoax. It just doesn't make any sense to even make that argument. I mean, Like, for what purpose, again, would this conspiracy exist? I think it's just a way of discounting information that you don't like, discounting claims that you're not reconciled to. And I don't even think, I think the people who really engaged in conspiracy theories back in the day would probably say, you guys aren't even trying. This isn't like, we used to do real conspiracy theories about how JFK got killed, some of which probably turned out to be true. And this isn't that. This is just going, oh, that's a lie, which is, and I sort of feel like that too. I think to get your conspiracy theorist license, you need to do a little bit more of the actual gritty, you know, earth-turning work. And now it's just, there's a laziness to it all. I don't know if that's the point you're making or not.
Well, no, that's an interesting point you make. I think in some ways what you're saying is that conspiracy theories used to be elaborate and sort of constructed in a way that were not easily disprovable. And now they're using what is already out in the open in a way that is easily disprovable, like disproving that that there were crisis actors in the Sandy Hook shooting. So I think that's a great point. Also, I think what a great point that, you know, I had never thought of was the idea that if anybody has an incentive to prove that climate change is a hoax, it's the oil companies.
Yeah.
And so why haven't they done that?
Right. Well, that's a good way of looking at it. The way I was putting it was, you think there's some people out there who can steamroller over the oil companies. And I don't know who those people could possibly be. So yeah, I mean, I think we are in agreement here. And I also know that we're coming up on a break. So I got to take that break. We'll come back. We'll have a little bit more time for your calls. 888-720-9677. 888-720-WNPR.
I don't have to go to bed. I've got a small day tomorrow. Small day tomorrow. I don't have to use my head. I've got a small day.
All episodes of The Colin McEnroe Show are available 24/7 at ctpublic.org/Colin. Which is also where you can sign up for our delightful free fortnightly newsletter, The Nose Letter. You can listen to any episode on any podcast app. Have a question or comment? Email us at colinshow@ctpublic.org. Now, back to the show.
Thanks, Sabrina. Actually, what we ought to do is have Sabrina record something that just says, "And Gene Avitruda saved us from oblivion." Because it happens like, I don't know, every 5 days or so. So before the show started, yes, the phones didn't work. We couldn't figure out how to make them work. Which is a problem, you know, doing a show where there's no guests and just calls. That might be a little bit of a problem, but Gene Avitruda figured out something. I mean, it was like 103 when we had it all figured out, but it's fine. Also, our technical producer is Kat Pastor. Senior producer is Lily Tyson. Jonathan McPants is the producer of this episode, screening the calls. And I think that's all that I have to say about that. Our number is 888-720-9677. 888-720. WNPR, if you're into the whole alphanumeric thing. All right, here's Mike from Woodbury. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Colin. So one of the things that I'm most worried about in regard to the upcoming election, and there are many things I'm very worried about, is low-information voters, particularly Gen Z and, to a certain extent, I guess some millennials, who apparently don't watch TV news, don't read newspapers, get almost all of their news off of social media, you know, TikTok and Reddit, and which, you know, operates based on algorithms, not on information, not on truth. And I don't know that they fully understand. I mean, when they say they can't stand Trump or Biden, and so they probably won't vote at all, or they'll vote for a third party, I don't think they totally understand the difference regarding all the things that they ostensibly care about: the environment, women's health, healthcare in general, student loans, and by the way, Gaza, which is the big issue with Biden that they have. If they think that Donald Trump is not going to do anything other than give Benjamin Netanyahu carte blanche to do whatever he wants in Gaza, he could care less about Palestine. So I'm, and as someone who teaches people of this generation. I'm wondering if you have gleaned any information just talking to them about, you know, how informed they are. Maybe your students are more informed than most people.
Yeah, I mean, look, my students are poli sci majors at Yale. And when we did a whole segment on TikTok recently, and they were kind of pissed off at me that I was making them watch a lot of TikTok. They don't like that kind of stuff. I have one student who's kind of TikTok-y, very TikTok-y, but the rest of them are not. And so they're the wrong end for this particular study.
Right.
So,
right.
But I will say a couple of things about this. First of all, I think I wouldn't blame somebody, a millennial or a generation or a Zoomer. I wouldn't blame them if they said, oh, so you come up with these kind of crappy superannuated candidates who can barely string seven words together. And it's our fault that we don't find this a particularly interesting set of choices. Now, you're absolutely right, Mike, that these choices are very important, and they're very important in terms of the things that they care about. And certainly on something like climate change or Gaza, as you're saying, Trump would be a disaster from their point of view. What's a little bit more worrisome to me is that a candidate like RFK would also be a disaster on some of the things they care about, not so much on the environment, where he can plausibly run as an environmentalist. He's been pretty much, you know, most of his adult life anyway. But on Gaza, he's been an Israel hawk for a long, long time. Once described the Palestinians as the most pampered global minority in terms of the amount of aid and succor they receive from, I guess, you know, relief agencies and stuff like that. I don't think we think right now of the Palestinians as being particularly pampered. And I do also share some of your concern about TikTok. So we spent a lot of time looking at TikTok and looking at how information gets delivered on TikTok. Now, part of the problem is it's really short, but that's not, I don't think, the big problem. I mean, it's a linked problem is it's free of context. So RFK Jr., for example, has done a very good job. His team has done a very good job of making him into more of a TikTok candidate, also using podcasts and podcasts that are friendly, like, you know, a Joe Rogan podcast where there's no context because Joe Rogan, like, as far as I can tell, almost literally doesn't know anything. And on TikTok, you know, RFK can run as an environmentalist who cares about Purple Mountain's majesty. And they'll, you know, he can shield people from any information about his views about even vaccines or, you know, the other like weirder ones, like there's something in the drinking water that's creating more trans persons. And I mean, the stuff that just like, you know, person in a dirty raincoat yelling at a bus station. So it's a problem. But I don't want to do generation shaming because I think these young people are looking at us and saying, you screwed up the environment. That's why there's climate change.
Right.
You know, you've consistently elected candidates who, you know, who don't have coherent or appetizing views on a lot of these questions. And now you're mad at us because we use the wrong kind of social media and we're looking at our phones too much. And I think better to invite them in, better to, you know, instead of wagging our finger or saying, you know, you guys might be a big part of the problem, better let them in.
Well, I hope Biden is doing that. Apparently, the Biden campaign has some kind of presence on TikTok now, apparently. I don't, you know, but.
Yeah, well, they do. They do. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
not
a natural fit.
No.
But, everybody has to do that kind of stuff. But I think, you know, meeting them where they live is important. And I think it's also important to say they're not the only low information voters. You know, I mean,
no, absolutely not.
You know, I don't know how close you are to my age, but you know, I meet
almost exactly your age.
Okay, so you know, we meet a lot of low information voters, and they're not all looking at their phones all the time either. So anyway, thanks for your call. We should just do this just to do it because this is what makes this format one of my favorites. We are going to. I should go to Mary because I don't think we've had a call from a woman yet, but I think we're going to go to Mark in Wallingford instead. Hi, Mark. Oh, I didn't put you on the air. It would be so much easier for you if I put you on the air. Hi, Mark. Let's try this again.
Hey, Colin. I heard you mention Shostakovich, but I didn't hear what the context is. And I was just curious because that's one of my favorite composers.
I don't know. I was just, before the show today, while I was still at home, I was reading a clipping that that Mr. Karp had sent me. We have no time to explain who Mr. Karp is, but it was about Shostakovich and about how he wrote his 15th, you know, after the very moody and gloomy 14th. And then it made me also think about the scene in Maestro where Leonard Bernstein, he's in kind of exile from his family. And I think he's like at Avery Fisher Hall and he's maybe talking to one of those groups where people, you know, it was a semi-educational concert, the kind of thing that he used to do. And he talks about the 14th, but then he gives this little Bradley Cooper written speech about how when you get old, you should become totally free. You should become who you really are. If I had time, it's actually on my tablet, I could read it out loud. And I was just sort of, I mean, I don't know. There's all kinds of layered ironies in all of that, particularly when you think a little bit about the life of Shostakovich. However, we have to go because we're done. But thank you very much for calling. You made my day, Mark. And the rest of you made my day too, but in a different way.